Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature and religious studies, about his recent book, Secular Scriptures, Modern Theological Poetics in the Wake of Dante. Joining us to talk about the use of this book in the classroom is Chance Woods, a doctoral candidate in English, working on 17th century English poetry, particularly the topics of mysticism and conversion. And Chance is also teaching an intro to poetry course based on William's book this semester. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Chris, for doing this. It's such a wonderful service and stimulation for all of us in the Divinity School, and an enormous thanks to Chance for being here as well. It really is very, very moving for me. Chance is a close collaborator and a partner in dialogue and really in my projects as well. And I'm so happy to be able to share part of our conversation ongoing over the years in this way with you and then with a wider public. So.
Wonderful.
Let's go.
All right. So the introduction to Secular Scriptures begins as follows. Quote, "The essays in this volume demonstrate ways in which secularization is intrinsic to theological revelation, particularly in Christian tradition, and they highlight the role that literature plays in the realization of such revelation in the incarnate form of the Word." I wonder if we could start off with what you mean by theological revelation and what you mean by secularization and how they relate to one another in the context of literature. What do you mean by being intrinsic? Intrinsic to the other?
Yeah, no, that's a necessary question, it would seem, to start with, because I don't necessarily mean by theological revelation what would ordinarily be assumed by that. So I'm glad that you bring this up. And I'm going for something that is beyond strictly rational reasoning. Theological revelation concerns certainly our relation to others, to something that inspires us, that influences us beyond our own control. We all have this experience. Now, why would one call that theological? That seems to be bringing in some kind of a knowledge that, you know, not everyone would assume. And I don't mean theology in a dogmatic sense, but theology provides us with a vocabulary, with images and concepts for interpreting the unknown, for what we don't know how to describe when we have this intimation of otherness, of being in contact with, of being face-to-face with, or maybe obliquely in relation to forces that surpass us, that we can't quite account for. And theology, especially in the context of literature, has given us means for trying to express this kind of relation, this experience of relation, relation to the other, to the unfathomable. What I'm speaking about here is more negative theology, really, or at least we have to understand theology from the standpoint of negative theology, that is, what we're not able to understand. What we don't know is the primary impetus for theological imagination, for theological discourse and expression. God is a figure for what or who transcends all of our figures and all of our concepts. So theological revelation is inevitably poetic, as I understand it. It's an imaginative way of trying to cope with what surpasses our ability to give any kind of exact, scientific, verifiable account of things. Now, this always involves some kind of a reflection of us, ourselves, our experience, our world. It's secular.
Hmm.
Because whatever means we're going to use to try and approach, convey, communicate this experience of unfathomable otherness is inevitably going to come from the resources of our own immediate experience, ourselves, our world, right? Secularization, then, is inevitably a part of theological revelation so understood.
Mm.
All right, and I think this is what literature is very much about. All of our terms for expressing the absolute are inevitably secular. Now, I think then I also have to explain, sort of symmetrically, that by secularization, then, I don't mean something that is inevitably opposed to the religious or antithetical to theology. The secular is a worldly realization of human spirit, including ideas of divinity. These ideas often make reference to what is not worldly, so there is a tension within the secular as standing in relation to its own other. The secular, the worldly, is open to the otherworldly, right? And the otherworldly, the religious. See, I hear the word secular really coming from secatus, as meaning cut off. There's a sense in the secular world of being cut off from the source and origin of the world. There's that orientation towards what is not secular worldly within the secular.
Mm.
All right? And that's why an otherworldly poet like Dante, the poet of the other world, par excellence, is so important to this project. Now, I wonder whether I should just add as something of a codicil, something about Christianity this picture.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Is this these poets are most often, not exclusively, but this is sort of Christian epic tradition is certainly the main inspiration of the poets here in question. And the Christian religion does have a unique revolutionary approach to theological revelation as secular, as divinity coming into the world in the doctrine, of course, of the incarnation. Now, I would find incarnation in religions across the world, right? And, there's an incarnate presence is crucial, I believe, to biblical revolution, to biblical revelation in its Jewish sources as well. And yet, Christianity, in some ways, has been the motor of secularization in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of, God himself in person becoming a human being in the world is, of course, at the level of the imagination, it's an overpowering revolution in the conception of divinity. And in many ways, the modern secular world is, not by accident, and in crucial ways, a product of biblical religion, and in some ways, particularly of Christian history and culture. And this is something that Dante and poetic literature more generally can enable us to see, because religious poetic images are figures for what transcends figuration and reveals our world as itself, but as a relation to an otherworldly or unworldly mystery. Now, you quoted from the beginning of the book. I had the idea that I might read from the end of the book on this topic, just the last paragraph here of the essay on postmodern or poetry and Dante. Once again, theological poetics in the wake of Dante have been concerned with negotiating the revelatory power of the movement of secularization throughout this modern period. The seeming reduction of poetry and revelation to worldly manifestations surprisingly releases another kind of power one that exceeds human calculation and control, in the direction of worldly and incarnate realization of the infinite potentialities of the poetic world. Of the poetic word. Yes, you're right. Entering into the flesh and becoming secular entail a crucifixion of the word and of religious truth narrowly conceived. But precisely this martyrization of the word has been an exceptionally fecund source of revelation throughout the modern era and even beyond. The postmodern and premodern projects of Gianni Vattimo, the postmodern philosopher, and Dante, respectively, rediscover in mutually illuminating ways the extraordinary potential of secularized interpretive understanding for releasing and fomenting the revolutionary ferment gestating in theological revelation in and for and beyond the modern age. So, you know, I thought that was was perhaps worthwhile to bring into conjunction with the quote that you started with. That gives us some sense of Christianity, really, as the canonic religion of the undoing of its own discourse, of really it is the image of crucifixion, of the word as well, that I think do help to open the space here of secular scriptures such as I explored in the book.
You mentioned a little bit about literature and modern poetic literature. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what modern poetic literature consists of for you. I mean, it's clear from the book that you cover certain authors, but I'm sure that's not the whole of what you mean by modern poetic literature. So what are the boundaries? What do you mean when you mention modern poetic literature? And in what senses do you see this as scripture? Scripture is a very interesting, complex term, and people have very firm views about what it is. And so, what are you meaning by calling modern poetic literature scripture?
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, maybe I'll start with the last part of that, and I would like to hear that word at two different levels, with a small s. First of all, these are writers, right? Scriptors, if you like, in a very straightforward sense. Writing is the craft of all poets, and I do mean to say something about poetry in general, even though you're right that there's a very specific focus, and yet it is something universal that is at stake here. And of course, then the poets, the ones that I'm focusing on, in many cases do approximate in their writing scripture, even with a capital S. That is, there's some sense of a superior level of insight reached beyond normal mortal understanding. You know, we have this in the Invocation and Paradise Lost. I'm looking at Chance at this point. That's one of the pièces de résistance in his dissertation. So there is the general and the specific. Mm-hmm. So the poets have been selected for their strong theological interests, or possibly even anti-theological interests. Leopardi is very much an atheist, as have been many modern poets, but nevertheless in the religious dimension, right? When you are denying God, that too is in some ways a theological discourse. I consider it a necessary theological discourse when we're coming from negative theology, right? That negation is intrinsic to whatever positive figurations, affirmations of a theological nature are going to be proposed. So I do choose these poets as being universal poets, poets who really have an epic dimension that speaks to the whole of human life, history, the cosmos, right? They're in this book not merely as lyrical voices expressing personal feelings, although that's part of the cosmic as well. But these are ones that do take the poetic to its most universal level. And where the distinction between the scriptural with a small s and scripture is some sort of a divine revelation becomes questionable, moot. There's some sense of a threshold that can perhaps be crossed. Of course, it belongs to the tradition of poetry as inspiration, right? The muses, the goddesses. So this is the claim that poetry can make, especially in some of its epic expressions. And so there's, in some sense, I might make an argument for each of these poets as being modern epic poets as well.
So before we turn to the modern epic poets, or at least a few of them in the book, I wanted to ask a larger question about how you would describe what you call your own original speculative outlook on literature and how you came to this outlook. Because what you've written is not, a sort of literary theoretical book that you might typically find. So you have a particular perspective on what you're doing, and I'm wondering how you would describe that and how you came to it, really.
Well, I came to it through philosophy.
Okay.
And through Hegel, specifically, as the speculative philosopher par excellence. But I would say that his speculative approach to philosophy is continued today, notably in the school of hermeneutic philosophy. We can say philosophical hermeneutics, which I taught here for several years at Vanderbilt when in the first years of my teaching here. And what I understand really by speculative, among other things, is that what we are teaching, what we are talking about, is not only an object such as literature, poetry, or some philosophical system or idea. The speculative is always also about thinking itself. There's always the dimension of self-reflection in what is speculative, right? The word itself suggests the image of the mirror. And that gives our thinking a further dimension beyond merely the objective description and analysis of some subject matter. It's also about us. It's about our very act of thinking, right, in this mirror effect. And that opens the field of discourse without limits, really. Everything that I am in relation to and contact with that influences me is also a part of what I have to say. The speculative dimension really, opens our investigation to considering even explicitly all of the background factors that impinge on us and that might normally be filtered out, but actually we have to become cognizant of them as well for our thinking to fulfill its purpose of opening the mind without restrictions, without objective limits. So there is then this philosophical project, which is also very much a part of my method, in any case, in approaching literature and in contemplating the mysteries of religion at the same time.
Dante.
And I'm just wondering, because I know that I think that speculative method is something that Chance also has has made his own in many ways. And do you bring this up at all with your students? Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. The title of my course is technically Between Philosophy and Revelation, an Introduction to Poetry. And going back to Plato in many respects, poetry is put on the outs with philosophy. However, even in Plato's Phaedrus, you know, Socrates makes it clear that there's one species of divine madness that he would allow into the citadel of reason, and that is you know, divinely inspired poetry. And he says the trick is trying to discern, you know, which is divinely inspired as opposed to what is, what he calls it merely rhapsodic or merely merely just born out of human genius. And, you know, for Socrates, that means that those kinds of poets are merely just like sophists. They can, they're very clever at bending words, but they don't have a deeper connection to something primordial or an intuition of the absolute. And, you know, in the Platonic tradition, which also becomes very important for the Christian tradition, they also come to theorize, that this becomes very clear in someone like Plotinus and St. Augustine, that the mode in which we read scripture, that we read the poets, is as important as the poetry itself. And so the speculative enterprise of interpreting poetry needs to be on the level of poetry to discern that divine madness that Socrates would allow in. And when I foreground that in the class that I teach, the students quickly kind of surmise that this is not a question of either or, but oftentimes a very difficult negotiation between the discursive, the philosophical, and the revelatory and the immediate. And they're very intrigued about that third way that they're not commonly told about in popular culture, but is so nicely exemplified in William's work.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah.
So let's turn to some of the figures in the book, and I wanted to start with Dante for probably obvious reasons. Dante, particularly his Paradiso, is central to your thinking. A number of your previous books have been oriented around this author and his work. With one, the Revelation of Imagination from the Bible and Homer through Virgil and Augustine to Dante, exploring forerunners to Dante, and a little plug because we had an interview about this many years ago. The current book moves out from the poet to more recent authors, but circles back at the end to consider him in light of postmodern thinking and consider postmodern thinking in light of Dante. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how the literary and philosophical context in which you've placed Dante in this book have enriched your understanding of his work.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I understand Dante as the culminating point of ancient and medieval tradition, and then, symmetrically, as the departure point for modern thought and culture. I really bring both the, you know, the history up to Dante and then after Dante into focus around this central point in our cultural tradition. And all of these historical dimensions and disciplinary fields enrich our understanding of Dante, and vice versa. Now, you know, part of what I'm saying really to Dante scholarship is that we really understand Dante, obviously from the ancient medieval tradition, and this has been the stock and trade of Dante scholarship all along, but also from another book, actually my first book, Dante's Interpretive Journey, 1996 is the publication date. I've really been arguing that we have to understand Dante not only in terms of what comes before, but also what comes after him. The subtitle, which is not in the officially published book, was a hermeneutic dialogue between the Commedia and modern thought, and that really has been my project for, you know, all along. I think that Dante helps us to focus ancient and medieval tradition on the as a quest for prophetic revelation, right? For discerning the meaning of history and the destiny of humanity and the world. And in some ways, this is literature's highest calling, to participate in this discernment and even to make it real by bringing religious myth into secular and worldly enactment. And I think that this suggests then also how Dante is the source for modern culture turned to actively constructing our world. This is the more characteristically modern mode, homo faber. Dante is an emergence of self-conscious subjectivity, right? In his medieval context, this man who stands up and, as an individual with his personal history, not just an allegory, an everyman. This has been noticed. Eric Auerbach is famous for foregrounding Dante's realism. Charles Singleton, as well. Dante is the first modern individual. He's celebrated as such, by historians and literary critics alike. Very much then, a birth of modernity can be seen in Dante. But there's also the face-to-face with the other, with the theologically figured other, which has not yet been erased in Dante. That's why he's so important, I think, to me and to us as well, because it's losing that relation to otherness, to one another, to the other, with a capital O. You could think of that in ecological terms as well. All of this has become a menace to modernity with its endemic narcissism. And I think we find an antidote to this in Dante, where the self-affirmation of humanity and its self-conscious self-reflection is held together with an orientation to, a devotion to the other. And not by accident, there happens to be a redemption of the figure of Narcissus that one can trace through the Commedia. It's especially in the 30th canto of each of the canticles. In the Inferno, you have the actual phrase, lo specchio di Narciso, the mirror of Narcissus, comes up in the discourse of Mastro Adamo, right? The Adamic figure for humanity, by virtue of his name, Master Adam, is in some ways, I think, revealing the narcissism that damns us all. There's a moment then in Purgatorio, and especially in there's several moments, but in the 30th canto where Dante mirrors himself, right? He's in the process of purgation. He's ashamed, right? And he has to confront this distorted, fallen image of himself and be repulsed by it, right, in order to undergo the necessary purgation. And that self-mirroring moment, too, is a narcissistic moment. And then in the Paradiso, you really have the celestial rose and all of the blessed are mirroring themselves as well. The rose is mirrored in the lake. It's all a play of self-mirrorings. And I think this is really the celebration of Narcissus redeemed. That even the divinity, God himself, in the Trinitarian understanding that is developed in Christian theology, is a self-mirroring relationship, right? The Father and his perfect image in the Son. And that is then the love of the Holy Spirit that becomes fecund and fertile and reaching out into all of creation in spreading the love that originates in this narcissistic, within quotation marks, narcissistic relationship right within the Godhead itself. So, I would then see Dante's place as between the medieval world, the ancient and medieval world on one hand, and the modern world. And it's really that in-between position that makes him, you know, so powerful, to my mind, for reading our whole cultural heritage and finding really, you know, what we've lost, how we can regain it, revive it, what we need, and all, you know, where we're going as well, what we haven't attained. Dante really opens our modern age to the kind of self-reflection that we need for our salvation, you know, to put it in sort of Dantesque terms. You know, the relation to the other is really explored by Dante through prophetic revelation via figures of theological mystery. And that becomes then, I think, a paradigm for the kind of modern poets that I explore in the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about some of those poets right now, but I've made selections because we don't have time to talk about all of them. But I'm hoping that the selections that I've made in the discussion will whet the appetite of listeners to explore the rest of the book on their own. So the one section that was of particular interest to me is another sort of transitional text, if not a transitional figure, and that's Shakespeare's play Hamlet, in which you explore, in this particular chapter, you explore the work of Hamlet in the context of a transition between knowledge frameworks, one based on revelation and the other based on science. Could you talk a bit more about what this transition entails? What is this transition? And how do you read Hamlet's negotiation of it in light of what came before, especially what you've been saying about Dante, and then in anticipation of what follows?
Mm-hmm. Well, I might say that the transition is more of a rupture,
okay,
and a wrenching. That's what I really want to emphasize here. In Hamlet, it leaves us bereaved, and it is tragic, right? I don't want to lose this tragic dimension of Hamlet, which does happen, actually. I have a certain discussion with Franco Moretti in this book, who I believe erases the tragic dimension of Hamlet. What is being lost? A connection with the other world, with the medieval past, which is now represented in the shape of the father, the dead father, King Hamlet, who comes back as a ghost and haunts Hamlet, with, I think, the sense of what's been lost. And of course, there's his dread command. And this is what poses the problem for Hamlet. Could Hamlet act on that dread command immediately as a revelation from another world, right? A prophetic revelation. Oh, my prophetic soul, says Hamlet, right? When he hears that there's a ghost wandering, right? This is something already that his prophetic soul has revealed to him. He's still connected in some way with the previous episteme, right? The, you know, the paradigm for knowledge based on prophetic revelation. He still has that connection, but he doesn't dare to act on it. And in some ways, this is how, you know, he feels that this is his tragedy, his undoing. You know, it's his fatal flaw in, you know, in our undergraduate papers. But it is, I think, a tragedy for modern civilization, which is already being worked over here. Now, why does he not act immediately? You know, as he berates himself for not doing so. You know, why, you know, why am I still here, to be, to not to be, you know, in his questioning, his self-reflection, which becomes an obsession, becomes a kind of play-acting that upstages the real task that he's been given, right, by a kind of injunction from the other world. Well, he's a student in Wittenberg. He's been exposed to the new methodologies, you know, the new scientific outlook. It's expressed by his companion, fellow student Horatio, who is skeptical about this ghost and says that he's not going to believe anything except by the sensible and true avouch of mine own eyes. Right? This is the new criterion of knowledge, is empirical proof, right? The ocular proof. That's the new episteme. And Hamlet tries to get proof of the king's, the current king's Claudius, right, his uncle's murder of his father, as revealed to Hamlet from the ghost. He tries to get proof of that by the mousetrap, right? He's going to do an experiment, right, in order to prove, I'll have grounds more relative than this, he says, you know, than the ghost's word. He wants to have some sort of empirical proof, and he shows us the tragedy of losing the immediate connection to theological revealed truth, and, you know, becoming immersed and enlisé, you know, really entrapped in the new kinds of procedures for verifying and proving that do come then to dominate the modern world, which shows, I think, one of its tragic aspects in this play. There is some kind of redemption as well, I believe. Should I, mention that? Yeah. Did you want to?
Well, I'm not sure if I could offer evidence for redemption, but I would have some comments to follow up yours if you want to.
Yes. Should I? Yeah. Why don't you go ahead if you're ready? We'll try and come back to redemption.
Well, as you were speaking, I was just reminded of Levinas' famous, you know, phrase that Shakespeare was the greatest philosopher, in part for this very reason, because I think one of the things that Hamlet dramatizes so nicely is the same point that Milton dramatizes through the figure of Satan, which is this alluring and elusive possibility of being self-authoring, of authorizing your own existence in a certain way.
Yes.
And in some ways, that is the new kind of epochal shift that comes in with the Reformation in the wake of Luther, that stripped of the institutional sacramental framework of meaning, all of the, as it were, theological weight falls on the shoulders of every individual believer. And that's an immensity that many people can't bear.
Yes.
And Hamlet's deliberations about whether he should commit suicide or not,
yes,
you know, is really the confrontation, as Levinas says, with an impossibility. How can you authorize yourself to end yourself when you don't know what will happen anymore beyond that, when, you know, outside of that sacramental framework, which gives some intimation of the afterlife, you really don't know if you will cease to exist, which introduces even further that paradox of causing your own non-existence, which seems to be absolutely the question in the early modern age, which is so different from kind of the Dantean world, where you have a framework that Dante is moving within, but also kind of transcending at the same time. So Shakespeare's dramatizing something that would resonate, I think, very deeply with the people watching his play, you know, in this age, the early 17th century, but it's involving so many complex psychological factors,
yes,
that it's, as you say, starting with different premises than what Dante would start with.
Yes. No, I, you know, that's very, very insightful, I think. And Hamlet is the tragedy, the isolation of an individual. I think you're right about that.
And this pertains to your question about narcissists, too, this idea of
yes,
full self-regard. For Dante, he's always trying to narrate himself. Into
yes,
this poem, the interval between the poet and the pilgrim is always one that's being negotiated, but Hamlet seems to be pridefully seized of owning his own self when he actually, I mean, he realizes the tragedy might be that he doesn't have that position anymore, and he must let go of himself to be free of that vicious cycle,
yes,
that he's part of.
Well, I think he does find a way to do that in the end, and this is what I mean by redemption. And he expresses it in terms of there's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. He says it's a faith and a kind of fideistic belief in providence. What he cannot see or know. But he has a kind of belief, nevertheless, that heaven was even in this ordinant, that he had the seal of his father so that he was able to change the letters commanding his death when he was shipped off to England and turn it into a death warrant for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern instead. And he does find some way, even without knowledge of the other world or of God, nevertheless, believing in the unknown as providential. I think that this is a new modern way of constructing some sort of a relationship to what we don't know and what we no longer believe is revealed in crystalline theological terms. He says, we defy augury. That's a phrase that is very resonant with me as well. We defy augury. We don't have any privileged access to metaphysical truth in the other world. And yet he remains attuned to the inscrutable purpose of heaven with a kind of readiness. It's sort of like Lear, ripeness is all. He says, ready now or whensoever, right before he goes to the final duel with the king. And he's going to die with the poisoned sword. But he's ready to respond to chance and circumstance as offered to him by providence. In some ways, this replaces prophetic sight into the purposes of heaven. It's faith in a higher purpose, a sort of negative religious belief.
It seems to me to be also a recalibration of Luther's sola fide, in that sense,
yes.
That only his belief will save him. And it hasn't been lost on Shakespearean critics that, Hamlet's on his way back from Wittenberg, as you mentioned earlier, the epicenter of the Lutheran Reformation. So I think there are a lot of thematic issues at play here, much to your point.
So, I think the redemption that I'm talking about, when we think about it, however, does not really redeem Hamlet from his isolation. That really remains. And so the point that Chance made earlier about the lack of the kind of community that Dante enjoyed remains in place, and that's tragic about our modern condition as revealed by this play.
The other section I wanted to talk about is the one on Emily Dickinson. And listening to you talk, I began to wonder about whether you would want to make connections between Dickinson and Hamlet. But the specific question that I had for you had to do with your comment about Dickinson's poetry that, quote, her poetry is in some sense to be understood as a spiritual exercise, a use of poetry as a means of approach to an unknowable divinity, or at least as an instrument for registering an impossible, inarticulable absoluteness in her experience of the ultimate reality, unquote. So I wonder if you could talk a bit more about Dickinson's poetry as a spiritual exercise. And I wanted to ask you to relate it to, since we're not going to be able to really cover them in any detail, some chapters on the poetry of symbolism, Blake, particularly on Blake, Baudelaire, and Yeats. But I also wondered if any of the discussion about Hamlet might bleed into this as well. So I leave it to you to answer. But I'm particularly interested in what her poetry as a spiritual exercise means.
Well, I think what you quoted from the book brings out especially the negative theological underpinnings of Dickinson's Poetics. And that is a thread that we can bring through from the very beginning of our conversation through Hamlet as well to Dickinson, who nevertheless does expose it much more broadly and baldly than has been the case really in the poets that we've discussed so far and in the poets that you name that come after Dickinson in the sequence of the book, of the discussions of the book. Her poetry is very openly and directly what I identify as a negative theology. I can't, this is not necessarily the traditional interpretation of Dickinson, not explicitly, not in those terms. And nevertheless, when I read any of her poems, I always find them as articulating a negative poetics sort of in the shadow of a negative theology or that in the shadow behind the negative poetics we find a kind of negative theology. And I thought maybe I should even perhaps read one or two of these poems. Some of them are short enough. There is no silence in the earth so silent as that endured, which uttered would discourage nature and haunt the world. There we have a nice haunting image, like the ghost of Hamlet. But it's when it's uttered that the silence haunts the world. It would discourage nature. It can be endured when it is silence. When we try to articulate this religious dimension, which is recalcitrant to any of our figurations and expressions, it does become something haunting. It's incommensurate with the world of objects that we are familiar with, that we can measure and manipulate. There's this dimension is called The Missing All by Dickinson in the poem that gives that chapter its title. And so I would like to read this poem out as well. The missing all prevented me from missing minor things. If nothing larger than a world's departure from a hinge or sun's extinction be observed, 'twas not so large that I could lift my forehead from my work for curiosity. All right? There's this missing all that is incomparably greater than any thing, any objective lack or misfire, even the whole universe as a positive entity, the object of astrophysics or whatever. Even that, if it departed, it's nothing in comparison with what's missing from that objective order. There's this greater everything that is infinitely greater than any mere thing, the entire universe included. So this is the dimension of the negative that is the ground and principle of all like God in her imagination. And this is the dimension of negative theology, which I think, comes forward so irrepressibly in every one of her poems. And it can be engaged through a kind of spiritual exercise of ascesis, and even linguistically, this is what apophatic poets have to employ, invent, and realize a kind of ascesis of language in order to take back their language, undermine their language, in order that the non-linguistic somehow become manifest indirectly. There's a sort of spiritual exercise, I think, that Emily Dickinson practices both at the spiritual level in her devotions, whatever they may be, and in her poetics as well, of renouncing every word and image as not adequate to what she's really trying to let speak. And this practice, then, or exercise, would typically be seen as opposed to symbolism, as a sort of positive expression in language. And we have, you know, great symbolic poets, Blake, right, the eternal humanity divine, and all of the marvelous imagery, Galganusa, you know, and all the rest, or Yeats, with, you know, sailing to Byzantium, the symbolic repertoire that, you know, we have from Romantic poetry forward into modernism is really impressive and overwhelming. And yet, I would maintain that something of this negative outlook and discipline can also be expressed through symbolism. And in the poets that I've selected, the symbolism is also inhabited by a kind of hollowness where wholeness is achieved or is in some way intimated and touched. Symbols can express the otherworldly, or maybe more to the point, the world as other as well. All right? It's not just a matter of the objective content of the symbol. Symbolism in the poets, in Baudelaire, Yeats, and Blake, symbolism is also used, I think, to open up this dimension, really, of the unfathomable. Now, symbolist poets are makers of myths, right? I don't want to deny that at all. I want to really emphasize that. But they're also unmakers of myths. And this is, I think, then what Dickinson is bringing out more explicitly, the negative vocation that is really tied to, that works in tandem with the vocation of mythologizing. This is something else that I want to get Chance's point of view about. Mythology can fix significances, and this is why Roland Barthes was so leery of myths, mythology, mythologie aujourd'hui. He sees language as being fascist, to use his term, quite simply, frankly, fascist, because of its inherent myth-making tendencies. But language, and symbolic language in particular, can also self-critically deconstruct its own myths. And this is where I would really see the importance of Dickinson's ascetic spiritual practice of poetry as bringing out something that then is also at work in the other poets too, when we consider the way in which myth and apophasis work together. And this is something that I learned a lot from Chance. I have to say, he's been investigating this topic in some areas with ancient Gnosticism, for example, that I have found very, very intriguing for continuing to develop some of my own ideas.
Well, it's interesting, apropos Dickinson, because she was once called the only authentic Emersonian, because she took Emerson as her point of departure, but she disagreed with him in almost everything, and she wasn't afraid to voice that. But in addition to some passages from William's book in the course that I'm teaching, we started with Emerson's famous essay, The Poet, in which he calls the poets liberating gods, because they emancipate, he says, through symbols. And he goes on to explain what he means is that, symbols, deriving from the word symbolone, to cast together, putting together two things that ostensibly shouldn't be together, escapes that kind of totalizing and overdetermined tendency of philosophical discourse to have an overly kind of rarefied meaning of something. So, in essence, a symbol can wake someone up, it can show the world aright in a new way, and he's convinced that those possessive what he calls poetic genius are the truly authentic ones, the truly self-reliant ones. And I think that that's one of the great misnomers about Emerson that Dickinson, I think, beautifully dramatizes, which is, you know, Emerson's taken to be a very individualistic philosopher in some ways, an atomistically minded person. But if you read Self-Reliance, Emerson says, you know, nothing makes sense of the individual except the missing all, you know, the grounding in the absolute. So there's no such thing as an individual extricated from everything else. You know, the individual can only be an individual when grounded in a larger framework of meaning in some ways. And Emerson's convinced, and I think Dickinson proves, that poets sometimes are more gifted in making that point clear and showing how symbols can liberate more dramatically than philosophy or other forms of discourse can. And when it comes to myth, I mean, mythos is the, you know, is a narrative that affords coherence to those things in many respects. Plotinus, in his Aeneas, famously says that, you know, the myths reveal the truth in the only way possible that truth can be conveyed. Philosophy can't do it. It lies to the philosopher to make sense of myth, or to the theologian to make sense of myth in scripture. But the myths themselves are what provide that framework of meaning through their kind of collocation of symbols on various levels that lead to the need for hermeneutics, as William said earlier, you know, the endeavor to interpret, to bring people out, to explicate these texts. And Dickinson, in, you know, these concise poems, is able to really dramatize that.
Mm-hmm. By, you know, opening the myth, the narrative, to a continuing dimension, actually, you know, reiteration, but also reinterpretation. And, you know, when myth has that dimension of ongoing openness and of inexhaustibility, so that it cannot definitively say, really, what it's saying, then it does work, you know, towards this dimension which we've seen opened in Emily Dickinson as the missing all. So I really want to emphasize the synergism as, you know, that's at work between the negative theological apophatic moment and the myth-making moment. And it's when they're together that they really do become productive and I think life-giving. Whereas we do know that myth can be killing and very dangerous and does have to be subjected to philosophical critique, but not as if philosophy then could be the definitive authority standing over myth to tell us what it really means. On the contrary. Yeah.
I wanted to turn to a question about communities as a final question about the book before asking Chance to talk a little bit about his use of this book. The title of the book is Secular Scriptures. And among other things, scriptures are both constituted by and help to constitute communities. You note at the beginning of the last chapter of the book that, quote, literature can be thought of quite broadly as a secularized form of religious revelation. This is what we've been talking about. This is especially so if we take religion to be concerned with underlying myths and rites and other forms of cultural invention and relation that constitute communities, often unconsciously, unquote. So how would you characterize the communities that constitute and are constituted by secular scriptures, both those you discuss in your book and others that we weren't able to talk about? And a little intriguing thing that you say at the beginning of the book, given the, quote, seemingly angelic powers arising from hyper-reality and virtual worlds, unquote, that you mentioned at the in the introduction, what scriptures might be constituted by these new hyper-real and virtual communities appearing around us today? Okay. Taking it maybe in a little different direction, but
okay. Well, I'll try to get back to that last point, which is you know, a bit of a challenge. but I think I should say first that I don't intend secular scriptures as a prescription for constituting an ideal or utopian community. Mm-hmm. That the scriptures constituting the community of Western industrialized world at various stages of modernity are secular simply reflects the nature of modernity as a secular age, focused on human self-will and mastery and subjugation of the world by technological means. So the point of my title, for me, Secular Scriptures, is that however secular our communities may become, there is still something scriptural, and now with the capital S, or something in some sense transcending the control and mastery of a rational calculus that goes into their constitution. Love, for example, or freedom, or God. These secular scriptures open some space beyond the world of objects as we're able to master it and manipulate it for our own purposes. Now, that means that our communities also have to be open to an other, and otherness to other communities. This is really some sort of a plea for an openness to theological mystery and to religious bondedness among human beings and to free creativity of the imagination, that all of those elements of community are crucial beyond the pragmatic forces that can constitute a community. Our religious imagination takes us beyond that rational calculus, and it's necessary to constitute any kind of a vibrant community, I think. Now, there is, I think, a place for virtual worlds and hyper-reality, even though that sounds very technological. And so it really, it first suggests to us the technological means in cyberspace that have demonstrated such phenomenal and unprecedented powers. These powers are quasi-divine or demonic as well. They enable us to transcend time and space, right? To watch what's happening right now in the middle of China. We use them with Skype all the time, and in some ways this is a religious dream come true of being omnipresent, right? So, technology does furnish means of realizing even spiritual community that, exceed what our wildest imaginings in a lot of ways. And these new means are being worked through some of the experimental poetic projects, for example, La Poésie Sonore. In France, there's a lot of multimedia experiments now, by creative poets, and writers, and it's not even clear whether they're simply poets. That category obviously has to be burst asunder. I would say that in the literature that I deal with, we come closest to this with perhaps James Joyce, and he's not in this book, but he too is in many ways a culmination of poetic language as theological revelation. I treat him as such in another book, Poetry and Apocalypse, right? There's really the whole second part of that book, which figures Joyce as the culmination of the Christian epic tradition. But he also, has this multimedia play that creates a kind of hyper reality and opens us to virtual worlds. We could explore this with Rimbaud's Illumination as well. But I suppose the reason that there is that gesture that you brought out, because it's not developed in the book, because technology is in so many ways the antithesis of the poetic creativity of spirit that I'm celebrating in this book. But there are at the same time ways of trying to overcome this alienation and working with technology creatively so that it does not dominate us or simply serve us in our penchant for domination of the material world, but can open us to otherness beyond the reality that we control and manipulate. Technology is phenomenally stimulating for our imagination. And in so many ways, it seems to have realized the spiritual capacities that were envisioned in religious literature, and done so in real time. So the technological means that I'm alluding to there per se are incapable of conceiving the other. Technology controls what is. It recognizes no other. There, one or zero. Those are the only alternatives. There's no state of otherness in between. For the exploration of what is neither one nor zero, neither unequivocally this or that, the non-objective, we need the human imagination. But of course, the imagination has everything to gain by working with technology rather than rejecting it. Even though technology does pose a certain threat to imagination and to everything human, we can forget our capacities if we just download it all onto our device. And there is some sort of a struggle between that kind of technological manipulation and thinking. But I would like to find the ways of flipping that over into really a productive synergism, and I do think that is eminently possible, but it's going to take some effort and reflection on our part. When our students are all there looking at their screens in front of them, and we're trying to awaken them to thinking at the same time.
We talked about narcissism earlier too, which is certainly at least in the popular discussion is certainly something that's come up with regard to the technologies that we have.
Excellent. Yes.
We forget that the word authentikos in Greek, one version of it means the person responsible for the murder. We're all trying to be authentic by claiming lives here online, and it's actually compromising our own selfhood.
Good. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Chance, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about yourself, particularly what you've been working on in your doctoral work, and then we can talk a little bit about how you're using William's book in your class.
Absolutely. I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm in my final year, finishing up my dissertation currently. I hope to defend in April with William's presence at the table. And the title of my dissertation is Transfiguring the Ineffable, Mysticism and Conversion in 17th Century England. And the idea of conversion might seem a somewhat kind of odd pairing with the idea of the ineffable or the idea of mysticism. However, I think it kind of harkens back to an older trend in scholarship. I'm thinking primarily of someone like John Fruchero, with whom William was familiar at Stanford, I believe, who wrote a book called The Poetics of Conversion, when he talks about one of the most important foundational myths, if we're going to talk about kind of mythography and mythology, is the myth of the self and how we kind of narrate our lives. And this is a very important topic in the 17th century, especially in England, when conversion is kind of the great issue of the day. Kings from Charles I through James II scare people when they associate too openly with Catholics, because there's a possibility that they might convert to Catholicism and thereby undo a century of Reformation. Many of the most famous writers of the period, like Ben Jonson, John Donne, Richard Crashaw, John Dryden, were all converts. Some were on their way to Catholicism, some were on their way out of it, or back and forth in the case of someone like Ben Jonson. But conversion is a very important theme for exploring the self and what it means to actually have a sense of self in a certain way. And of course, the two most archetypal converts in the Christian tradition are St. Paul and St. Augustine, both of whom have this seismic sudden change that takes them violently out of their own world, and it's their respective narrations of that transformation which becomes so pivotal for later writers in this period. They also happen to both be mystics. You know, 2 Corinthians 12, Paul has his own ecstatic journey to the third heaven where he has a revelation of unspeakable words, he says, and he can't tell anyone what he encountered there. And Augustine also has his own mystical experience. But thinking of Fruchero and William's work, the importance of authoring the self vis-a-vis the question of the unknowable or God or the absolute is something that William has explored quite trenchantly in The Revelation of Imagination. I'm thinking primarily of the chapter on Augustine, where in narrating one's life, one doesn't so much assume absolute control of one's life, but you actually divest yourself of that pretension that is exemplified in Hamlet or Satan in early modern literature. And, you know, Augustine has this beautiful phrase where he says, you know, in multa defluximus, you know, we are dissolved into the many when we associate with various dimensions of the world, maybe even technology today. You know, we presume to have this control, but what we don't realize is that underneath it all, we are losing our sense of self because we're presuming to have too much control over ourselves. And, you know, my dissertation explores how poets of the 17th century were, many of whom were converts, or at least used the discourse of conversion, to explore identity, to explore the unknowable. What does it mean to be caught between two worlds, two worlds you feel equally part of, in the way that Paul was a very devout Jewish man, and then he becomes a very pivotal figure for early Christianity. Augustine is an avowed Manichee and Platonist before he becomes, a forthright Christian. But this kenotic form of selfhood that William talks about kind of in much of his work, this emptying of the self, which is a foundational Christian principle of you must lose yourself to find yourself in some ways, is many of the ideas that I explore in my dissertation, which at every turn almost takes its point of departure from William's pivotal work.
Well, and you are using, you're actually basing a good bit of your course this semester on this book we've been talking about. So, how do you use it? I mean, what's your method? What's your process? And I guess we'll leave it at that because you've already talked a little bit about how his ideas have affected your own scholarship. But if there are any ideas that have come out of this particular book that have affected your thinking and scholarship, you want to talk about that too?
Absolutely. This book has proven central to both my personal reflections, but pedagogically as well throughout the semester. William's work is really in a class of its own, but if it had to be put into a category, I would put it into that mode of criticism like Eric Auerbach or Northrop Frye, scholars who are trying to have a universal vision, to really go beyond a certain period to encapsulate a tradition like secular poetics in the wake of Dante. Auerbach himself wrote, a book on Dante as poet of the secular world, and Frye has a book on the idea of secular scripture as well. It's a very important idea because students come into the classroom oftentimes presuming that you have religion over here and you have philosophy over there. Never the twain shall meet. Literature is something nebulous, it's something liminal. We don't know what it is. It's imaginative. It's kind of its own thing. But kind of taking my point of departure from secular scriptures, I reveal that many of the poets that we look at, which are the poets that William covers in this book, they are using an idiom that's manifestly theological, but they're not always doing it for orthodox or institutional reasons. So even someone like Dante, who students are always so surprised to see Dante putting popes in hell. How could this avowedly Catholic poet do something like that? And Milton, who's the consummate rebel against all forms of institutional Christianity, and Blake even more so, saying institutional religion is that poisonous system which really prevents you from seeing the truth that has its true location inside your own heart. But someone like Leo Pardi, who, as William intimated a moment ago, very secular, turning away from the shadow of Dante, turning away from Christendom, he is able to talk about the infinite in a way that is very that resonates very deeply with the students. And if I had to say that I have a method in teaching the course, it's really trying to use the specific critical idiom that William alone, I think, has really pioneered over the last 10 years to talk about these poets, because people have been discussing these poets for a very long time. Someone like Leopardi is not quite the household name that Dickinson or Shakespeare is in the English imagination or the American imagination, but it necessitates, critics like Auerbach and Fry both said that criticism itself must almost approach the level of the poetry it's trying to elucidate. And the qualification almost there is important. This letting the poetry be its own domain, but also aspiring to have that clarity, that mode of exegesis or explication that brings as much clarity and revelation as the poetry itself presumes to be able to do. And whether it's just quoting a paragraph from William's book or paraphrasing in my own words some of his insights, I've noticed that the students really do open up to the infinite power of many of these poems and these poets. And they come up to me personally and thank me for giving them access to poets or re-enchanting them with poets that they kind of knew about, but they had not heard covered in that way or explicated in that way, which only proves, I think, Auerbach and Fry's point and William's point that the mode of criticism is as important almost as the poetry itself. So how we teach, how we describe these poets is very, very important, and there couldn't be a better model for that, I think, than William's scholarship.
We could have an entire discussion about what you were just saying about re-enchantment, which is a fascinating area too. But unfortunately, I think we need to close things here. But I really appreciate the conversation. I'm glad it's been such a good conversation.
Yes. No, thank you. Thank you both, Chris, for hosting these discussions and Chance. What a unique chance, really, for us to. To be able to engage you in this way. As you can see, it's Chance is a phenomenal opportunity for me to have an interlocutor and a challenging collaborator with all of my work. It really is a blessing.
Well, I'm so very grateful to have had this opportunity. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Again, I've been talking with William Franke, Professor of Comparative Literature and Religious Studies, about his recent book, Secular Scriptures, Modern Theological Poetics in the Wake of Dante, part of the Literature, Religion, and Post-Secular Studies series published by the Ohio State University Press. And we were joined by Chance Woods, a doctoral candidate in the English department working on 17th century English poetry, particularly on the topics of mysticism and conversion, and also teaching William's book in an introduction to poetry class this semester. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.